Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is Jeanette Abney, and I want to first thank you for joining me here for another exciting episode here at Precious Predicaments at Blog Talk Radio. And for those of you that often frequently listen to my show, I want to first thank my Heavenly Father for waking me up this morning. I also want to share that I did enjoy spending time with my family and neighborhood friends in Compton at our 10th Friends and Family Celebration. I just plan on being there doing more, and hopefully more individuals can come out and join us in the city of Compton as we normally get together once a year for a Friends and Family barbecue. So stay posted on Facebook. It was fun. I want to thank Sean Cook and Bruno and Michael Sawyers and all of you guys that put the events together, and also our cook that did the barbecue because them ribs was banging. So you got to say, show me your recipe. So I just want to put a shout out to them because I really enjoyed spending time with them. And, you know, it's kind of like the old saying, you never forget where you come from, because where you came from can also be a life lesson and an experience. It's basically how you perceive it and what you take from it. So today, again, like I said, I want to thank you for joining me. We're going to have a very long episode today. And as usual, somebody want to send me a text message. They always want to text me as soon as I go on the radio. But today's message, or today's topic, basically have to do with the mass incarceration and its effects on others. Now, this is not to be a stereotype thing. It's not to be, you know, have a lot to do with racism or anything of that nature. It's to inform and to educate and to basically teach individuals what this is about, so that we won't fall victim or fall prey to what individuals always say, the system. Now, I'm a licensed therapist, and I'm the owner of 2 outpatient counseling centers. And one of the things I notice, especially when I'm working with a lot of my court-referred and probation clients, is they always want to say, the system, the system, the system. So I have them break it down, and I say, what is the system? How did you get caught up in the system? Did the system just come knock on your door, or did you get into some trouble? And a lot of times individuals find it hard to believe what role they play in it. And that does not mean that people do not abuse the system, which is why we're going to be talking about this. Because part of it is, no, we always say when you know better, you do better. Now, as we talk about mass incarceration and its effects on others, the wounds from incarceration, you know, they view it as a moral and a policy failure. When we talk about policies, it's like, who writes these policies? Where do these things come from? Where do these ideas come from? Is it something that individuals was just basically set out to do? As I was doing my research, I was getting information regarding Jim Crow and the new Jim Crow and all that information. I was like, wow, I haven't heard that before. Start talking about how it damages families, communities. Today, we're going to be talking about the ways that it damages individuals. And I have several special guests. It looks like somebody just hung up from the 909 area code. So hopefully they will call me back. I think I know who it was, but I'm not sure. So if that was you, please call me back. So we're going to be talking about this. I'm going to have individuals on the air today share what they're doing, whether it's projects or things in the community. Because I always say, let's stop being part of the problem and let's create solutions. So let me join my first guest. Hi, this is Jeanette Abney. Welcome to Precious Predicaments at Blog Talk Radio. How are you doing?
Hello. I don't know if I'm the first guest technically, but Alexis Miranda here.
Yes, you are the first guest, and I want to thank you for joining me. And yes, I'm going to join the other caller, but then we're going to start with you and what you're doing, okay? Hold on for one second.
Okay.
Hi, this is Jeanette Abney. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good.
Okay. I thought that was you. Okay. So I want to welcome you for joining the show, too. So that's 2 of my guests. We got some more people that we got calling in. I put a shout out to individuals that were in law enforcement, that's in the realm of therapy. I've even told some of the individuals, because I think the person that kept contacted me last night at 1 o'clock in the morning. I told him, I said, you look like you in a situation, you know, because he looked like he was contacting me on Facebook from prison. I was like, okay.
Oh, man.
You know, because he was like, well, what are you doing, and who are you, and I checked this, and I only saw one light. And I'm like, I am a real person, and I'm doing my part. But I want to say, you know, I have been wanting to do this show. And then when I saw my little cousin's thing that she was doing, I was like, wow. So I want to let you know, Alexis, I am so proud of you. Even though I always get you and Ariel's name confused, and Tisha always have to stop me. She'd be like, Mom, that's not Ariel, that's Alexis. Or that's Alexis, that's not Ariel. So
everybody does it.
And then I had to remind you when I contacted you to let you know, okay, this is who I am. So even if you don't remember me, I know you remember my mama. So you was like, I know who you are. So, Alexis, tell us who you are, what you do, and tell us about your project that you have going on.
Hey, I'm Alexis Miranda. I am an actress and a writer here in Los Angeles who is currently producing and directing a short film about the impact incarceration has on mainly African-American families. And so, yeah, that's what I do, and that's what I'm doing now. The film is called Orin. And most people, when they hear about the subject matter, they say, oh, well, is it a documentary? And I'm like, no, it's a narrative film. It's a story that follows a father and a son. And we basically show how when the father becomes incarcerated, how they both kind of do this downward spiral together, like parallel to each other. And really, it just speaks to the fact that, you know, this entity, this mass incarceration, this system has created a vicious cycle in African-American communities. So now you have several generations within one family being incarcerated. And so, yeah, that's what I'm doing. I could go on forever. I'm like, I don't want to talk forever. You want to interview?
Well, you know what? I'm going to give you that platform because I extended the show because there's a lot of individuals that are, you know, working behind the scenes. And a lot of times when individuals, it's like kind of like, where did it start? Where did that mindset come from? Because, you know, we used to always say that prison was a state of mind because you can be free but still be imprisoned. And my concern was, what are the factors that lead up to that? Because I wanted to put out there and the disclaimer that we're not saying that individuals don't commit crimes, but I will say that the crime rate is actually lowering now. But then there are innocent people that go to jail, but part of the problem has become, why are they going to jail? What resources are out there that are available? What help is there for individuals in the community? And those that do make a mistake and go to jail, what is for them when they get out of jail? You know, because people don't understand it. I remember growing up, and my grandmother used to always say, if you keep yourself out of the cemetery, I will keep you out of the jailhouse. And that was instilled in me, but I really didn't know what that meant. And it took me as a minor getting arrested, going to jail with my mother and my grandmother for fighting. And I think to this day, I still owe that woman an apology for the way I beat her down. But part of that was because that ain't funny, Roy. It was a learned behavior. It was a learned behavior because I just remember my grandmother kept saying, if you keep yourself out the cemetery, so I had to make sure I didn't let nobody kill me. And as long as I didn't let nobody kill me, if I got in trouble, my grandmother was going to come and get me out. But the problem was she didn't realize she went right along with me, my mama, and my grandmama. And they said we were three generations of gang members, and I've never been in a gang in my life growing up in Compton. But I used to always have a mentality, what would you do if somebody called you and said that a woman under the influence of PCP jumped on your grandmother? So the first thing we did was me and my mom, I woke her up. We went over there. I knocked on a woman's door. I allegedly had something in my hand, and I beat her so bad with it, she was unrecognizable. So today, if I would have done something like that, I probably would have been put up under the jailhouse. But I can say that my grandmama did get me out. I don't know what the hell she did, but we all got out. But by that same token, I knew then I'm not going to jail. This is not right. for me. And that's just a matter of juvenile hall. I was a straight-A student. I was a drum majorette. I was class president. I had a whole lot going for me, but I could not shake that cycle of violence and this sense of, well, what they going to do? What they going to do? My grandmama going to come and get me. And that was a problem. So we have another call coming in. So I'm going to log them on. And then let me, hi, this is Jeanette. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. How are you doing?
I'm fine. And she didn't come get me.
No, you had to suffer.
She left me in there.
So she left. Wait a minute. Mama left you in jail. Mama didn't come. Wait a minute. They couldn't come get you because everybody
sister.
Had a warrant.
My mama nor my sister came to get me because of what happened with y'all.
I know. We was all in trouble. So we was in trouble. Then when you got in trouble for beating somebody up, you had to just stay in jail. You po' thang you. And you was part of the United States military.
Exactly.
That was the sad part about it. Couldn't nobody come get you out. I was a minor, so I was excused. I couldn't come help you. But that is so, so true. So, okay. All right. I want to, that's the next guest that called in. Roy, share.
Yes,
I want you to tell us your perspective on this because you have a lot to add to this topic, too.
Most definitely. First of all, my name is Roy Colbert, and I'm also in the entertainment field. I'm a writer and producer and director of film television. I think it's a, it kind of started, I believe, at least in my opinion, you know, because I've taken a look at it. Matt, it's called criminalization.
Mm-hmm.
The art of taking a group of people and criminalize them and classify them as people who commit crimes. And to me, I think it just is a system that allows to set up pensions for law enforcement. For many, many years, you know,
mm-hmm.
when, you know, they charge people with either minimum or, you know.
I break everything, and I'm no longer here to repair it.
Mm-hmm. Somebody got some background noise. We got to close that background noise back there.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's just a system that allows for law enforcement to secure pensions for many years. I could remember... just looking at and identifying, you know, that process, you know, which is you go into these communities with a group of law officers who, you know, think they're some of them think they're doing good things for the community by helping out the people, but in all actuality, everybody who lives in let's just say a drug infested area. Everybody who lives in that area aren't criminals, and they are not participating in the things that go on there.
Correct.
You know, but as a result of some of this behaviors, and also the effort of law enforcement, these things happen.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have now is you have generations of people who have been incarcerated and who have been criminalized. You know, a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong; there are criminals out there, but a lot of people. Don't look at everyday life as I need to get out here and commit a crime.
Correct.
But if you live in those areas, you know what happens is, you know, they label you, and then
Correct.
You know they arrest you and harass you on the things that are going on in the community, but you're not a part of it.
Correct.
So what happens is you get go ahead, mm-hmm. you get large groups of people who get arrested.
Correct.
And as a result of it,
No, what I want to say is, you're right, and growing up in Compton, I saw a lot of that in just the neighborhood and the community that I lived in, and how things was glamorized, how, you know, things was taught, how it was, the belief was them against us and things of that nature. And even though today we're going to be talking about how incarceration affects community, and they look at it as a disease-based model, and there are researchers that are trying to help understand how prison admission rates are linked to the health of a neighborhood. And I also want to say that even in these neighborhoods, I want to also not only add to the health of the neighborhood, but also the wealth of a neighborhood. Because I was looking at something that was on Facebook, and somebody had posted something about a guy in Baltimore, and he got sentenced to 25 years in prison for selling drugs. And he had cars that I couldn't even pronounce the name of some of them cars. You know, he had homes, he had this, and it was glamorized. So when you start taking things and bringing them into the community, and then individuals start looking at that and they want to get out of the community, some may not view it as a crime. And then they start coming up with all these laws and these policies, and then we have to try to figure this mess out. And I also want to say, also start off by giving information in regards to what is the difference between prison and jail. Because when we talk about prison and jail, some individuals, especially in impoverished neighborhoods and communities, they view going to prison as a rite of passage. And we have to teach our young children that that is so not true. And once they get that mindset, they think that they're supposed to go out and do things of that nature. Now, as we watch the news, we watch television, we watch all of this stuff, and we see that. But in the United States, we often encounter basically inconsistent use of terms, prison and jail, because they're not the same thing. Now, the accuracy in using these terms shows a higher quality of media coverage and what we see on TV, and also to improve our public understanding of the justice and public safety issues. Now, I'm going to give some information that I just got straight off the internet, and it has to do with the definition of jail. Jail is a secure facility that houses three main types of inmates. One, people who have been arrested and are being held pending a plea agreement, trial, or sentencing. Two, people who have been convicted of a misdemeanor, criminal offense, and are serving a sentence of typically less than 1 year. And three, people who have been sentenced to prison and are about to be transferred to another facility. Now, jails are operated. Excuse me?
Go ahead.
Jails are operated. By a county or government, city government, which is what you were talking about. Jails are also known as detention facilities, are facilities in smaller communities where one to a few arrestees can be held for a short time pending transfer to a nearby jail or detention center. Now, a lot of new detainees are delivered to the jails daily. Some may stay less than 1 day or only for a few days until they're okay to be released in a court proceeding. Some are released after putting up bail and are released to pretrial service or caseload. Now, a considerable number of people arriving at a jail are actively or recently either drunk, high, arrived with injuries from fights or assaults that led to their arrest, which is a whole other issue. Some are mentally ill with no other place for law enforcement to deliver them. And this makes the intake process a challenge for jail staff and medical personnel. Now, with prison, a prison is a secure facility that houses people who have been convicted of a felony criminal offense and are serving a sentence of typically a year or more. And some individuals get sentenced to life. Now, prisons are operated by a government or federal government penitentiary, which is synonymous for prison. Some are public and private, too. Now, the number of sentenced inmates entering the prison each day is far less than the number of people delivered at the doors of the U.S. jail. People who are going to prison, they know it in advance. They may be transferred from a jail, taken to a prison from court after conviction, or report to prison on a date set by the court. Now, when we talk about prison and the definitions, it gets real fuzzy from place to place because we have state prisons. We also have federal prisons. So there's two different types. We supposed to be, they used to say it was about the concept was providing treatment, which was rehabilitation, which a lot of times that becomes questionable. We talk about the incapacitation, which is a concept of putting offenders in a secure facility to prevent him or her from being victimized by the public again, which it becomes questionable. We talk about the retribution, which is a concept where offenders who serve time is paying back society for the harm done in the crime. I'm getting to that, which that becomes questionable. And we talk about the deterrence, which is a concept that knowing that someone else was punished for a crime will make another person less likely to commit the same crime, which is a very low efficiency. This does not, in fact, work. Because when they came up with the three strikes law, that was a problem. And I can truly say, even being a mother, I remember the first time my son got arrested and went to jail. He reminded me, he said, "Mom, I remember when you paid all that money for that attorney, and that attorney was trying to get me to sign a deal for 13 years in prison on my first offense. And that lawyer go tell me, you know, because he said since my son was an adult that I couldn't be in a room with him while he was talking to him about his charges. But my son had enough sense to say, my mama ain't paying you all this money for me to go to prison for no 13 years, and I've never been to jail before. Now, if my son wouldn't have known any better, he probably would have signed that deal out of fear. And then when he got in trouble again, what you going to say, Roy?
Exactly. That's one of the tactics they use, lawyers and public defenders. If they know that you have never been involved with a crime before, the first course or the first action is to intimidate you.
Mm-hmm. And I had a paid attorney. Because I was like, I did not want my son to be a young black man institutionalized and placed in the criminal justice system. But then I noticed that the more he kept drinking, the more trouble he kept getting into. So I got to the point, I said, you know what? And I bailed you out of this one. I put up all this money for attorney fees. I am not going to keep doing this for you to justify your behavior. Then it got to the point that every time he went to jail, it was alcohol related or something stupid. And he got to the point to where they was trying to pretty much give out football numbers. I had to tell a lawyer one time, you got me jacked up. I am not my son. I just watched you railroad him, and I am not you. How you think I'm going to pay you for you to sell my son out? So, and a lot of parents don't know what to do. I was just a different type of parent, and I myself had studied law and, you know, was very well acclimated in the criminal justice system. So I knew better. I knew better. But he finally got to the point to where now he's 32. He's like, you know what? All of this was a waste of time. But when he was younger, I couldn't tell him nothing. So I got to the point I said, well, you know what? When you go, you on your own. I'm not visiting. I'm not putting no money on your books. I ain't doing none of that. Okay, Ariel.
You know what, Jeanette? Unfortunately, I feel like that's where a lot of black mothers are. And so I feel like, okay, we know where we are today, and we could talk about, like, the difference between prisons and jails and what's going on with the police departments and whatever. You know, they're getting paid to bring people in and meet quotas. I think to understand, like, everything that's been happening now and everything that is happening now, we really have to examine where all this came from.
Correct.
And so,
I'm on the radio right now.
Started because it's hard to really.
Okay, bye.
Hello.
No, I was talking to one of my god brothers who just called in and was talking to Jeanette. Okay.
I would like to say that he talked about criminalization. What's your name, brother? I forgot. I totally forgot your name.
Lord.
You said something very key. You brought up criminalization of black people. That actually started in response to the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and that's something that we have to realize. And so, they started to – that's when you heard the United States government. They were really big on, like, law and order. That's where all this stuff started. And so really around that time, too – we got to understand that deindustrialization happened and globalization happened. So we saw a lot of these blue-collar factory jobs disappear from black communities and white communities. But there was aid and support for white communities. So the black communities at this time, right after the civil rights movement, they basically, like when I say the unemployment rate, like it's almost like black communities were reduced to almost a third-world country.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I'm not trying to, like, and that's not even an exaggeration. So you saw joblessness in mass in our communities, and that's when they started to really ramp up this talk about, okay, law and order. And so you had prisons like Angola Prison being filled with a bunch of black men who really at that time were just trying to make a way and provide.
You're right.
Like, they So, like, a lot of this started happening, mass incarceration, really, and not saying that people, you know, there weren't violent black men and all of that, but what I'm saying is a lot of these people, a lot of these black men disappeared from their homes because they were trying to provide in response to economic collapse of their community.
Correct.
And
you
so,
know, if you, and if you, go ahead, I'm sorry, but if you look
what,
at
what
so
I was
so
going to
say
is,
when this happened, when you take these people who are nonviolent, and you put them in an institution that basically makes them violent offenders. Because when you go to prison, you could go in being a decent human being who made some mistakes and come out not even recognizing yourself. Because you're put in a system where, you know, like Angola prison, I'm going to use this as an example. It got a lot of press in the 70s because they said it was like the bloodiest prison in this country. I was listening to an interview from a brother that spent 40 years in solitary confinement in Angola prison. He was a Black Panther. He said when the Black Panthers, when they started putting us in prison at this time, we saw what they were doing to people. They were corrupting people, and it was systematic. He said they would, these young black boys would come to prison and to adult prisons, and they would sell them to older inmates. So you're looking at the corruption of a people, and it's happening over time. And what do? They release these people back out into the world. So they take this back to their communities.
Correct.
So we got to, like, I mean, this is so deep. The rabbit hole goes so deep.
It is very deep. It's very deep, Alexis. And you know what? And it gets to the point. We got a caller on the line, and I want to join him in because I know he said that he was going to be doing an interview pretty soon. Let me log him on. Hi, this is Jeanette. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. How are you doing?
I'm all right. This is Aaron Harvey.
Okay, Aaron. I caught you. I don't know. You finished with your interview already?
Yeah, we were just filming an introduction speech from Assemblymember Dr. Shirley Weber for our Document Me conference that we have coming up August 5th.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on about 4 or 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, you know, and I'm glad you was able to join in on the conversation because a lot of times we start talking about things of that nature, and a lot of times many people don't realize what they've gotten themselves into. And I understand what you're saying, Alexis, when I was talking about my son. Well, part of it was I didn't know what to do to break the cycle. And I didn't want my son to think that I was condoning that behavior because I took my son out of Compton, brought him to Oceanside. I did everything that I could possibly do to give him a better life. But the sad part about it was he still had that same Compton mentality that he left when he was a child. And my son left Compton when he wasn't even 2 years old. And I couldn't understand if it was hereditary or what, because his father was a hot mess. And I was trying to create something totally different, and I still struggle with that. Now, I have another caller I want to add to the line, Aaron, and then I'm going to let you share what you do, okay? Give me 1 second.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, I'm clicking. Hi, this is Jeanette Abney. Welcome to Precious Predicaments at Blog Talk Radio. How are you doing?
You're talking to Nick McNeil.
Hello, Mr. McNeil. How you doing?
Hello.
Okay. I'm glad you were able to join us. Okay, Aaron, tell us what you do, why this topic is so dear to your heart, and tell us about the project that you have going on.
Okay, so I am the co-founder of an organization called Justice for SD33 and also part of another organization based out of Southeast San Diego, Pillars of the Community, where we advocate for those that have been negatively impacted by the criminal justice system. And we just say that's a fancy way of saying pretty much everybody. What kind of like got me into activism was I believe this was the summer of 2014. Me and 33 other individuals were incarcerated and charged with conspiracies to commit 9 murders.
Wait. Back up 1 second, Aaron. So that the listeners can hear us, please reduce your background noise because I can hear other noise and it kind of affects when the other listeners are listening. It can be a distraction. And the information we have to share is very important. So I know we only have myself, we have Aaron, we have McNeil on the phone, and we have Alexis. So let's check our background noise so that it's not interfering with the message and the information that we're trying to share. Okay, I appreciate that. Okay, Erin, so you said it was how many of you guys that got caught up in this?
So it was me and 33 other individuals. We were charged with a penal code, 182.5, which says that if you are documented as a gang member, you can be held liable for crimes committed by that gang, whether you had knowledge of it or not.
Wow.
Specifically speaking of me, I was living in Las Vegas at the time, studying to become a realtor. And, FBI kicks in my door one day and says I'm wanted for 9 murders in the state of California. It was kind of crazy. I didn't even think it was the police. I thought it was the military. The way that it came with dogs and helicopters and the type of weaponry and things that they had. I tell them, you guys have a mistake. It's a lot of Aaron Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
So they show me a picture of my face. Oh, sorry about that. I just get in my car.
Okay.
And it was me. So we go down to the station, and, I tell them, you guys got the wrong person. Anyway, I end up spending about 29 days in a Las Vegas County jail, not knowing what I'm actually being charged with. And then I end up getting extradited to the state of California, back to San Diego, where that's when I found out I was being charged with that penal code 182.5, and that there was 32 other individuals as well that had been charged with these crimes. My attorney says, Your Honor, during my arraignment, my client doesn't have a criminal record. He's been living in Vegas for the past couple of years. You don't wait till you're 26 to go on a shooting spree. And the district attorney says, we know he didn't do it. We know he wasn't there. Mm-hmm. We know he didn't facilitate or assist in any kind of way, but we have him documented as a gang member. And under this penal code, he can be charged with this. So the judge went back. They talked about it, came back, and slammed the gavel. And I was looking at 56 years to life on a $1.1 million bail. We did about 7 months in jail fighting our case, and the judge eventually dismissed it on me and my co-defendant, Brandon Tiny Dude Duncan.
We still got background noise. Please check your background noise, because we still got background noise interference.
Yeah, so...
I'm on another caller. Okay, give me 1 second. Hi, this is Jeanette. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. How are you doing?
Hey, what's up, Jeanette? This is your cousin, Cedric. I'm just jumping in right now. I had to take a nap. I was just listening to the brother that was telling a story.
Gotcha. Yeah. I didn't want you to miss out on that. So I wanted to add you to the call before the lines, because the lines are basically filling up right about now. And if you want to join in on a call, you can call in at 516-387-1914. I just strongly advise you to please turn down, whether it's your radio or whatever background noise, because we want to make sure that individuals are able to hear without the distraction of other stuff that's going on. So if it's my background noise, let me know. Even though I know I'm in this office by myself. But now I have a question for you, Erin, because you was very young when this happened to you. And I could truly say, like I said, growing up in the neighborhood that I grew up in, I saw a whole lot of stuff, And I was trying to get in touch with my significant other today. I didn't know if he wanted to join us, because I know he would definitely have a lot to add to this topic, because he was another gentleman that had got caught up at a very, very young age. And when he got caught up at a young age, he served 25 years in prison. And I remember he didn't want me to know what was going on. So I really didn't know anything, didn't have much to do with it. But then by that same token, when I was in communication with him and I would go visit him, and I used to say, oh, my God, this is just ridiculous. And I watched what his mother went through, which is what we're going to be talking about, too, in regards to its effect on the parents, effect on the children, effect on the community, because I watched his mother wait for him for over 25 years, and he served all that time, and we didn't know if he was going to be institutionalized or what, which he wasn't, because he was always focused on declaring his innocence and getting out. And I remember paying for him an attorney, and one attorney told me, they said, Jeanette, his conviction going to be overturned, but it's not going to be overturned until he do the time. And I'm like, but if they know he didn't do what he said he did, why are you giving him all this time? That just made absolutely no sense to me. And when I would write letters or, you know, contact the parole board or be on the phone when he was doing his parole hearings, and he would just get denied, rejected. And he was angry because he couldn't understand how easy it was to get caught up in that system and how hard it was to get out. Now, Cedric, I want you to share your experience, because you was fortunate, because when I tried to go into law enforcement, they wouldn't let me in. So tell us about what you do and your experience. Because I don't know, I guess because you wasn't really around us that much, so they didn't know you was kind of like really related to us. Because I tried every law. I tried probation. I tried the sheriff department. I tried the highway patrol. I tried everyone you could think of. So people that made me, my clients that made me made a commitment that I will go to law school to get that law degree. Because I had to go in through the back door. So now I get to do other stuff. So I still got my education in law. But tell us who you are and what you do and your experience with this.
Well, I've worked in, thank you, Jeanette. I worked in probation for about 14, 15 years. So I saw a lot of young people go away.
Somebody's phone ringing. Please turn it off.
That's not me.
Okay, I don't know who it is, but please either answer the phone or turn it off. Okay. All right, Cedric.
Well, like I said, you know, I did 14 years in probation, and Dad did 25 years at the Youth Authority, you know, so I kind of grew up in law enforcement, and I wasn't really raised to be afraid of people that went to jail and prison, you know what I mean? Because we've had so many people in our family that have done time and stuff, that it wasn't a big deal for me. You know, I used to go in there in the Youth Authority when I was like 10, 11 years old. And like when I got older in high school, I'd go play basketball and stuff in there. So it was never really like I never really looked at anybody that had to do any time or anything in a particular way. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it was easy for me to go into probation. I was super relatable, but the problem I found was, like, the kids, they wanted to prove themselves and, like, go to prison and go to the Youth Authority. It was like a rite of passage, you know. Like, I got to go do this time and show everybody how tough I am. You know, I was like, son, you don't want to do that, you know. You're going in the wrong direction, my man. And then when they get out, you know, it's a completely different conversation. Because they have some sort of fantasy about prison in jail.
Correct.
That is a fantasy, you know.
Correct. Now, I have a question, because I was watching Power last night.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we get caught up in a lot of the media, the stereotypes. And, you know, we had our own little local drug dealers growing up. You know, I could say rest in peace, Julius Ward, and a lot of other individuals that I know and grew up with. And, you know, within my own community. But by that same token, do you think that the media kind of play a role in the stereotypes of what we see as far as our local drug dealers? Because, see, one thing, I like Power, I do, and I like that 50 Cent didn't kill him last night, because I didn't know how that was going to go down. But 50
Cent, he already shot his son, so.
He changed, because when he saw that his cousin was worse than him, and when he started, and he had to tell that young man he lied to him, I think it kind of touched him.
Right.
To where he realized, you know what, I may have been nobody all my life. I may have been this person that came from the hood. But you know what, I'm going to do something right now.
Right.
And I was like,
there's still a soul in there bumping around in there somewhere.
Thank you. And I was like, wow. Because you know what? I'm going to tell you, as a therapist, one thing I've learned is to separate who a person is from what a person did. I've learned that. You know, and my thing was, like I said, I saw so much and I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to do something different. I didn't know it was going to be being a therapist. I truly thought it was going to be being an attorney or a judge, because I thought that would be my way in. after I couldn't, you know, go into the law things because I think the MMPI test and all that kind of got me. So I got a hold of the test, so I had to learn what they were looking for. And I guess I just didn't fit their personality profile. But I want to start off by saying that 2.7 million children in the U.S. have at least one parent in prison. And when a parent goes to prison or jail, the whole family suffers. While the offender is inside, on the outside, the family faces their own form of punishment. Now,
well, Jeanette,
mm-hmm.
there's well, we have to talk about there were two different eras for black people in America, basically pre-crack cocaine and post-crack cocaine. And we're,
mm-hmm.
we've seen both because we're old enough, you know, that Compton wasn't nowhere near as bad as it was before crack dropped.
I know.
And, you know, it started taking, like the crack was killing the, you know, the crackheads, and it was also killing the dealer because the dealer was going to prison, so we were getting it on both ends. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it was, it just completely destroyed black communities. Like
crack.
All the young men that sold crack, you know, that normally would have went to high school and learned a trade if they didn't go to college, you know, would have became an electrician or worked
mm-hmm.
at the plant or did something. You know, their trade was moving keys. So,
correct.
You know, you're getting it on both ends. You know,
correct.
You're getting it, you're killing the, you know, the addict, and then you're killing the person that's dealing the drug. So there really have been two periods for black people in, you know, since slavery. It's been pre-crack cocaine and post-crack cocaine.
Correct. And I want, you know what, Aaron, I want you to jump in on that. What do you have to say in regards to that? Because I think that was part of the dilemma that you kind of got caught up in and things of that nature. Because like I said, I know that not only that, Cedric, you could talk about it from a perspective of what you saw in Sacramento. I know what I
right.
saw in Compton. And Aaron
right.
was in San Diego. And I know, Alexis, mm-hmm. you was in Texas. And then, you know, you came to Compton for a short time. And now you are in the industry. And we still see a whole lot of stuff. And I want you to also share, Alexis, what made you want to do this project? Because part of this is getting your project funded, and also with Aaron, getting your project to where individuals are more aware of what's going on. And I want you to also share about the upcoming event that you do have coming up on August the 5th. But before that, Aaron, share how you, because I know you said the gang part, and we know with gangs sometimes come drugs, and a lot of people always thought that the gang was more about violence. But they didn't realize that in some cases it was about making money. But then they didn't realize that they were hurting other people in their community. But what do you think about that, Aaron?
I feel like gangs are just a gangs are the symptoms of systemic poverty.
Mm-hmm.
A group of people who have been disenfranchised from main society will form their
mm-hmm.
own groups and create their own economic worlds, economic systems. And
mm-hmm.
government comes in and criminalizes it. I don't think anybody woke up one day and decided they wanted to be a drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's known a person who sells or cooks crack knows that that's not a glamorous thing to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
You might enjoy the benefits of it, but the actual processes of doing it isn't something that individual just wakes up and wants to do. People are oftentimes feeling so hopeless and left out that they feel like that may be the only choice that they have.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the sense of pre and post crack, the crack epidemic is no different from anything else that's been going on that's been put in the faces of black folks since Reconstruction. It's just another devised way by system to separate and destroy the black families.
Mm-hmm.
So we could go all the way back to the 13th Amendment, to the black codes, the slave codes, to Jim Crow, to the war on drugs, to the war on gangs. Right now we got the so-called war on terrorism.
Correct.
So I don't think it's anything new. I think it just manifested itself in different names, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how can we keep poor people, specifically people of color, back on the plantation. So that's
mm-hmm.
pretty much how I kind of looked at it. You know,
mm-hmm.
Where did this crack come from? you know.
Correct.
Right.
And you have a valid point there. You have a very valid point there, because that's one of the things that I want to throw his name out there, Leroy Brown. When I grew up in Compton, when he got in trouble and then Maxine Waters started getting involved, and that's what his main thing was, well, where'd I get it from? Who bought it in my neighborhood? Why I got to go to jail? I'm not jail material.
Yeah.
You know, things of that nature. And that is true. Where did it come from? Where did it come from?
Even with all that being said, I still believe that individuals still should be held accountable for their actions, right? But I also want it to be fair across the board. Now, if Michael get caught with some crack or coke and get probation, I want Tyrone to get probation as well, right?
Correct.
Right. And then may I add to that? We have to be responsible with the way that we punish people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes,
yeah.
you should be held accountable, but to be sent to a place where they're basically dehumanizing people and corrupting you on every level, that
mm-hmm.
can cause more problems in the future. So we really have to think about how we're holding people accountable for their actions.
Correct.
And we got to come up with better, healthier ways.
Correct. And people, you know, because, like, you know, some individuals are victims of circumstances, and then the topic has came up a lot. Should drug offenders serve a shorter sentence? Why is it that they're getting 25 years, you know, or life? Or, you know, like I said, when I saw the Facebook post of this guy who was making all this money and the police seized all this property and homes and jewelry and things of that nature, and he's going to do 25 years. So should sentences be shorter? What can you do to teach the individual? What can you do to bring hope back into your community? Because I know that I had said by the end of the year, I wanted to open up another counseling center in Compton. And I remember when I first proposed that almost 10 years ago, my auntie then was looking at me like, Jeanette, you on your own. But I'm willing to do that because I understand. But then sometimes individuals run into barriers when they do try to go into the inner cities and help. Because then we got to go through a lot of red tape. We got to figure out why they won't let us in. And a lot of times people in the communities are screaming, won't nobody help me, won't nobody do nothing. But when people try to, sometimes we run into roadblocks too. So part of it is we do have to start hitting things in regards to understanding laws, start being more active with policies and local government, and try to find out what part or what role can we play in this. Now, Neil, mm-hmm. you haven't said anything. You've been very silent, and I know you are very seasoned. What do you have to say in regards to this? Because I'm not going to let you just not say nothing.
Well, this is kind of outside of my expertise, although it's very interesting. I did grow up in Compton, but my era was pre-1960. So
mm-hmm.
the things we're talking about, I guess you can call it, like Aaron said, pre-crack. I know nothing about any of that. I left
mm-hmm.
there, and I left here in 60, and I'm now back in the Compton, and I'm seeing all this stuff now.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what I see is you have to get to the root of things.
Correct.
And my answer to that is educating our own children ourselves
mm-hmm.
and not leaving the education of our children to our oppressors.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we
yes,
have
sir.
Been doing, and that's what we're doing today.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I look at the whole thing. If we were the main educators, I think that would make a big impact on how our young children thought.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that is true. And I want to say this, Cedric. I know, Cedric, you and I have talked, and I said I need to create a forum because I wanted to do a man-to-man conference to be able
mm-hmm.
to bring young boys and bridge people together. Well, I'm telling you how God works. I received two emails from the city of San Diego where they're looking for
mm-hmm.
individuals to do RFPs for young youth that are in the juvenile justice system to mentor with individuals to try to help them change their lives. Now, I'm going to submit a proposal for that because
okay.
that is something I have a passion to do, even though I've been talking about it. But they sent me an email to my personal email, my business email. I'm like, you know what?
Right.
I need to get involved with this. because I did do my internship at Juvenile Hall. I enjoy working with the youth because I always had the philosophy that if I can help turn around a youth when they're young, that'd be one less adult in the adult prison system, especially when they started trying children as adults, because it can mess up their whole psyche and their life. Now, I know time is getting by us so fast, but I want to give some information in regards to the landscape of crime in the United States. Now, crime rates in the United States have been on a steady decline since really the 90s. Even though despite improvement, particular Democratic groups still exhibit high rates of criminal activity, and a lot of times they try to show us these crime rate areas to try to, you know, redline people in regards to insurances, in regards to jobs and things of that nature. But a lot of individuals left Compton many years ago, and many of them wish they wouldn't have never left, because now it costs so much to live in that city, it's ridiculous when you look at the price of houses. So they moved to these other areas and still found that they didn't have jobs. They still found out that they still had the same problems that they were running from, because it followed them. It even came to Oceanside when I left. Now, crime rates have steadily declined over the past 25 years. Now, there are also low-income individuals are more likely than higher-income individuals to be victim of crime. Now, it's interesting how our society make it look like individuals of higher income are victims, but low-income individuals are more likely. Now, the majority of criminal offenders are younger than age 30, and the disadvantaged youth engage in riskier criminal activity. Now, there are also federal and state policies have driven up incarceration rates over the past 30 years, and the U.S. incarceration rate is more than six times that of a typical OECD nation. Now, there are nearly 70% chance that an African-American man without a high school diploma will be imprisoned by his mid-30s. And again, that goes back to education. That goes back to opportunities. And I want to say, I remember, like I said, when I was talking about coming to Compton, one of the things I never forget where Brown told me, he said, Jeanette, you're going to run into a problem because many individuals lack hope. They have no hope, and they don't trust people. And rightfully so, not to trust. So, Ariel, I want you to tell us about your project and what it is you're doing, what you want to accomplish, and what made you write this film? Because I was looking at your information. But what gave you this passion to do this?
You call me Ariel.
I'm sorry, Alexis. I told you I do that from time to time. Okay, Alexis.
Okay. I just don't want to confuse the viewer. That's my sister's name. You know what? My cousin, the film is actually named after my cousin who I grew up with. We were close. He's like a sibling to me. He's doing life. Hold on. Hold the plane. There's a plane. He's serving a life sentence down in Texas without parole right now. And so I've always had interest in, like, criminal justice reform because of that. And I wanted to do a documentary, like, 13th. And so when it came out, you know, Ava DuVernay just directed the 13th documentary, which explains mass incarceration. It came out, and I was like, okay, she did it, dope. But one day I was meditating, and I saw the beginning and the end of a movie, like a story. And it moved me, and I said to myself, and this is what I think. I mean, we have these documentaries that tell us the facts. They explain, you know, how things happen, why they happen. But I think when it comes to art, when you actually have a story, a narrative on the screen that people can engage in and, you know, kind of like live vicariously through characters, I think that touches people on a whole nother level, on a deeper, visceral level. And so... and that's what I want to do. I want people to know what has happened in this country. I can't take race out of it. It's a very black experience. I want people around the world to know that, to feel it. Because when you get people on the same page, when people become aware, I mean, it's like planting the seed of change. And so, yeah, when you get more people aligned in saying, okay, you know what, this has happened and this is wrong, and you get enough people saying it from all different walks of life, black, white, Hispanic, whatever, then that you know, I mean, from that, it can't happen anymore. You know, you have people mobilizing and getting out in the streets and rolling up their sleeves and putting in that work. to bring this system to an end because it has to. It just, you know, I mean, so that's where that's my come from. It's a powerful story. I really believe in it. I feel like we have the potential to go to some major film festivals around the world, and I'm really excited. You know, it's just about getting people around this globe on the same page and saying the incarceration of black people in America, it's almost a violation of human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's just time that we move past this. And that's where I'm coming from. Hope I answered your question.
What do you need from me as a business owner? What do you need from our community? What do you need?
Well, right now we've actually already started filming the movie, and a lot of the principal photography is done. Moving forward, we're still in the process of raising $9,000 to complete this film. And I know that sounds like a huge number, you know, just hearing it, but if we get enough people to, hey, donate $50 or $20 or whatever, you know, we could do it. Like, we can do it in no time. So, yeah, right now we need the funds. I mean, if anybody has any, like, film resources, like access to people who can work as crew and wouldn't mind just coming in and doing it, you know, on some, like, hey, we're just going to, you know, I'll be a gaffer or I'll be a grip or, you know, I have experience. Or, like, any, like, dope editors. We need a really good editor. So, yeah, we're looking for, like, film resources and money. Money.
You know what, like you said, you have a GoFundMe account. And
yes,
can people find your GoFundMe account?
The GoFundMe account is www.gofundme.com, and that's /filmoren. And Oren is O-R-E-N. So that's gofundme.com/filmoren. And also, can I say one more thing?
Mm-hmm.
Also, in the future, I want to say that the lead actor in our film, he's from Dallas, and he is actually a convicted felon, and he's 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He's a convicted felon who's, you know, he's an artist as well, but, you know, he's one of the ones that really is out here. He's trying to turn his life around and get it moving. And so he's actually the lead actor of the film. And then also, I found out recently our sound guy from Dallas, because we filmed a lot of the movie where I'm from back in Dallas. Our sound guy came to L.A. to visit last week, and he said, Alexis, you know what made me give you a discounted rate on working on the film? And, you know, do you know why I believe in it so much? And I was like, you know, why? And he said, I spent 5 years in prison for something that I didn't do when I was 19 years old, because I was a young black dude who didn't have any support, and I didn't have access to, you know, the best legal representation and counseling. And so literally I just found out that our sound guy, you know, he went through this, and that blew my mind. And so also our team is talking about creating a program after, you know, this film, after we complete this film, to basically get felons, convicted felons, involved in the film industry. You know, it's so hard for them to find work.
It is. It is so hard for them to find work. I want to say my grandkids just walked in, not to change things around. My grandbaby is, how old are you? How old are you, Mama? My grandbaby is 8, and she had 3 seizures in 1 month. So y'all please keep her in prayer. I was so happy to see her walk through my door, because yesterday Tisha was driving her home, and my grandbaby just had a seizure. And we don't know why she's having these seizures at such a young age. It's crazy. So, yes, I got to take care of that. But you know what? I'm getting back to what you
said. They checked her for epilepsy and everything, Jeanette?
I don't know. I got
to
talk to her mom.
I need to go get off.
They just walked in the door, so I'm going to have to talk to them when I get off the air, because I'm just happy to see her, because I didn't know what to do. I'm like, I got to call the doctors. I got to get there. I got to find out what's going on with my grandbaby. How am I going to be just having seizures? So, okay, so getting back to what we're talking about, and, you know, it's interesting because people used to wonder, why did I marry my husband? And part of it was because we knew each other since we were 14 years old. And I knew who he was and how he was as a teenager. And, you know, we went to prom together. We went to high school. We did all that other stuff. And our lives just went in two separate directions. But I didn't want to be one of those that, you know, I'm marrying somebody in prison. I didn't want to live that type of lifestyle, because I saw him differently than that. But then I also understood a lot of the hardships, the struggles, the rejection, even when he got released, some of the things that he had to do to try to make himself realize, I'm still a man. I'm still a human being, despite
right.
what he had to go through for 25 years. And, you know, and it's crazy because trying to find resources and help. Now, Aaron, tell the listeners about, like I said, what it is and what you need and what you want the listeners to know, and also about your upcoming event that you have going on.
Well, first and foremost, with the curtain kind of being removed from this, you know, on this gang documentation, the main thing we go out to do is spread awareness. A lot of people don't even understand what gang documentation is, how people can even be documented as gang members, and that you could be incarcerated without ever committing a crime just based off being a documented gang member.
Correct.
And then the laws that have been passed, that once you are incarcerated with gang enhancements, gang conspiracy laws, gang injunctions, gang indictments, and things like that. So we just go out in the community and we just spread that awareness. And then we had Assemblymember Dr. Shirley Weber author a bill, AB2298, which finally allowed due process for now individuals can challenge their gang documentation. But for the past about 20 years, you know, you could be documented as a gang member and never even know. Police officer has mm-hmm. total discretion on who he wants to document, when, and why, based off
right.
9 very broad criteria. So now we have a new process set up where individuals could go in and contest it. And that's what our conference is going to be about on August 5th, is letting the community inside Southeast San Diego and outside and throughout the whole state of California know about gang documentation, how it
mm-hmm.
came about. And it's pretty much just like criminalization of culture that law
right.
enforcement is able to use to their abilities to keep this beast of mass incarceration going.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting you said that, Aaron, because part of the stuff that I forgot to share, which I wanted my son to call in, so I guess he didn't, was when he got arrested, the one thing that they tried to tell me was that he was a documented gang member from Compton. And yet my son was born in 1985, and I moved to Oceanside in 1986. I'm like, how the hell he gonna be a documented gang member from a city that he don't even live in? So he left before he was even 2 years old. And that was crazy. And that had a lot to do with why they were trying to give him the amount of time that they wanted to give him for a first offense, for a terrorist threat charge. And the terrorist threat
yeah,
charge
well,
was
there,
against
there,
his baby's mother, which would have been domestic violence.
There was an audit done in 2015 by the state auditor on CalGang. The showings, the results found that there were over 150,000 people on it. Throughout the state of California, 84% were people of color, and
mm-hmm.
there were 42 one-year-old babies
mm-hmm.
on this list.
Wow.
So your son might have been part of one of the 42 one-year-old babies.
Could have been, because his father was a documented gang member from Compton, and that was one of the reasons why I got my son up out of Compton. So it was just crazy. Now we have 27 minutes left, and I promised the listeners, and I basically indicated that I was going to be basically sharing information also in regards to the wounds from incarceration, some that never heal. Now we also, I want to share that there are children that are being born in prison, as not only men are going to prison, but also women are also going to prisons too. And some of the women that we see going to prison, some of them have mental health issues. They may have drug addictions, and then the children are being born in jail and prison. And I remember, I'll never forget, my daughter told me one time, my granddaughter, who's in my office now, we're sharing headphones right about now, so I can try to teach her about the radio. She was playing house with one of my other daughter-in-law's sons. My daughter overheard one of them say, I got to leave. And she said, where you going? He said, I'm going to jail. And when I go to jail, just make sure you don't sleep with none of my friends and don't spend all my money. And they was 4 and 5 years old. And I was just amazed. And I had to think about that. I was like, you know what? His father's in jail. My son was in prison. So these kids are playing house. And not only are they playing house, they're playing house talking about going to jail. And it was just sad, just mentality. And that gave me a outlook on how, when parents are incarcerated, how it affects their children. Now, even though we know in regards to incarceration, has like we talk, go up and down, things of that nature, and not just men going in jail to jail, but also the women going to jail. But I want to talk about and have some of you share how some of this affects the kids. You know, we see them having problems in school. We see sometimes they repeat the cycle. Sometimes they may have drug and alcohol problems, depression, anxiety. What are some of the other things? Because maybe some of the parents realize that when you leave and you leave your child, how the foster care system, what are some of those major impacts that you guys have witnessed? Because I can go on and on and on, because these are some of the things that I have to address these issues in therapy. But what are some of the other impacts that you guys see where it affects just the children?
Who are you speaking to specifically?
Anyone want to share? Whoever wants to go first?
Well, you know, it's like a death in the family. It's like losing a parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's even worse because you know where your parent is at. You
mm-hmm.
can't even wrap your head around the fact, you know, kids will start blaming themselves. You know how a child's mind thinks. Repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have somebody else raising your children. Maybe they're in foster care. It's not a family member. They're not connected to them. They're getting a check for your child every month. And if your child's too much trouble, he has the normal problems that a child has with being raised, they just ship them off and send them to another foster care.
Mm-hmm.
Until they get about 18 and they can't use them anymore. Then thank God we have AB 12 now, that kids that are aging out of foster care can get a place and get some money coming in and get situated as long as they go to college after they finish their time in a foster care. And I do mean time in foster
mm-hmm.
care. So we have, like I said, AB 12 is great. That helps. But, you know, when you lose a parent, you know, I couldn't imagine losing my mom at 5 years old, 3 years old, 2 years old. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And the repercussions that would leave on me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like devastating.
The research
mm-hmm.
shows that these kids suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder,
mm-hmm.
at higher rates than other kids. They have all sorts of emotional issues and learning disabilities. And then so when these kids have that and it's not treated and it's not addressed, like let's say we start putting kids on all these drugs, which that's another thing, you know,
right.
we treat their emotional and behavior problems as like, oh, okay, well, he's ADD or ADHD. Let's get him on
right.
this. That's another problem. And then, I mean, that's where the institutionalization of kids starts. And then they go to school, they get in trouble. Then you start putting them in detention. So it's like
mm-hmm.
it's almost like, you know, we've heard that the phrase pipeline to prison.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, schools are a
mm-hmm.
pipeline to prison, and that's so very true. So it's almost like we're grooming inmates.
Sure. And
you know
what? And that is
mm-hmm.
so true, and it's so scary because, like I said, I've grown up again in Compton. I've seen a whole lot of stuff. I guess that's why they say God put people in certain positions for certain reasons, because I guess you're equipped for it. Because, you know, I watched my mom, you know, I never watched her actually, well, I did see her go to get arrested before, but,
yeah.
you know, get beat up by the police. I saw, Cedric, I saw a whole lot of stuff. And then even when my father went to jail, I remember him calling us up. I'm talking to Eva Knievel on the phone with my father in prison. And, you know, I was like, this is just not normal. And I just wanted my children to experience something like that. And, you know, have to take my child to jail or, you know, visit a parent in jail. I mean, that's one thing I could truly say, that I never had to take my children to jail to go visit, you know, their father or anything like that, because I believe that's just, that's detrimental, it's damaging to a child. You don't want to break up that relationship. And then some parents don't even want to tell their children that they're in jail. They'll say, oh, well, daddy went away on work, or daddy's visiting a relative. You know, that's some of the things they used to do back in the day. But now kids
mm-hmm.
kind of expect it. They watch their parents get arrested and go to jail. Like, it's just no big thing no more. So,
yeah,
but,
definitely.
You know, and it,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. What would you say, Cedric?
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jeanette.
No, I was going to say, go on and finish what you was going to say.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's definitely like I said, it's a rite of passage now. A lot of kids use it as that, you know, because they want to be. You want to be like your father.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just do when you're a child. You want to be like your father, and everything mm-hmm. your father does is great. You know, I mean, that's why I got into law enforcement, because of dad. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know what I'm saying. So maybe that's why I'm an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like you're always going to mimic the person that you hold highest regard, you know. So if your father bangs and your father's in prison, chances are you may be headed there. You know, if your father's a doctor, you'll probably be a doctor.
Correct.
You know,
and that is true. But I could truly say, Cedric, when I got in trouble as a teenager, I didn't want to mimic them no more. I said,
No.
The devil is alive.
Yeah.
Y'all not gonna ruin my life. Had me all locked up. I'm beating folks with bumper jacks and tire arms, and I'm doing all this old crazy mess because y'all doing it too. Oh, no. I'm done. That's a wrap.
Yeah, but if it's all you see that's around, and there's a shocking statistic my sister sent me that only 17% of the African-American males in Sac County Unified read at a grade level. So one
mm-hmm.
out of the six young men read at grade level. That's
right.
A problem. There's
correct.
More education and more information, but the literacy rate's going in the other direction.
Correct.
So
and you know what?
Sense.
And a lot of it too, if it is it, a lot of individuals are functioning illiterate. There are individuals that did not learn how to read and write until they went into prison. Now I want to share some information, and it goes back to wounds from incarceration that basically never heal. And we talked about the mass incarceration. It damages individuals and communities in ways that scholars are just starting to explore. And even though they're looking at it, they're exploring it, politicians are getting involved, people are now starting to speak out because we are getting to the point where we're saying no more. And the thing mm-hmm. is, even though we're finding it's troubling because incarceration, we know, has increased, but crimes have decreased over the last 4 decades due to mandatory minimums on the war on drugs, especially there has been a 500% increase in the number of inmates over the last 40 years. Now, even
mm-hmm.
though despite the decreasing crime rate in the United States, lock up more other people than the nation when we talk about African-Americans, and that's why we're talking about this. Now, our judicial system, as we know, is very insufficient, and men and women who have not been convicted of a crime, what happens is they rot in unsafe, overcrowded, and understaffed jails waiting for their day in court. This is especially true in large urban areas. When we start talking about Chicago, when we start talking about New York, when we start talking about Los Angeles, that's where it becomes a big problem.
I'm so glad you said that. That was honestly another reason why I wanted to get this film off the ground. That encouraged me, you know, just looking at the crime rates in Chicago, you know, amongst young black men, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, we could talk about
mm-hmm.
crime rates decreasing, but they're it's actually increasing in a lot
mm-hmm.
of urban communities of young black
mm-hmm.
men. And so, and I mean, like, literally, it's like the Wild Wild West. And I was, you know, seeing that, and then also the police killings of unarmed black
mm-hmm.
men, and then the mass society justifying it by saying, well, these kids or that kid was a criminal. And it's
mm-hmm.
like, okay, well, hey, let's just address the root cause to why so many of these young men live the lives that they live. Like, why was Michael Brown?
Mm-hmm.
And so, all of this stuff is interconnected. Like,
correct.
The crime rate in Chicago...
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I'm listening to what you're saying. It is interconnected. And the bottom line is we have to kind of start at the top to get to the bottom. Because
exactly.
I can truly say, as a business owner, people don't realize the testimony that I have when it comes to what it takes and what it took for me to get to where I am. And I tell individuals that even though I may not be rich financially, I'm blessed with the opportunity to be able to touch the lives of so many people. Because I don't even look at dollar amount. I don't care about money. As long as I got something to eat, I'm good. But by that same token, I remember, you know, buying a company, people trying to put me out of business, having to relocate, dealing with the cities and dealing with local governments and people saying, well, we don't want a drug rehab in our facility, not in our backyard. But yet there were so many individuals who have family members who use drugs and alcohol, but they didn't want to admit that there was a problem and people needed help. And I remember my mother telling me before she died, she said, I didn't understand why it was so hard for me to be able to help these people. My mother said, baby, the system is designed to keep people in jail, and you're trying too hard to get them out. That's why they're trying to set you down. It made absolutely no sense to me, none at all. But by that same token, I just never gave up. I just continued to be obedient and do what I had to do, and I'm noticing how God is maneuvering people in certain positions. And as people are being placed in these positions, hopefully they will continue to be obedient and do what they're supposed to be doing too. Because we will run into obstacles. We will run into red tape. We will run into people who will abuse their power and their authority, or they let greed, or they take advantage of the disadvantage. And that's where trust becomes an issue. Now, when we start talking about that and things of that nature, and I want to go back to, because I know I'm going totally off topic, but when we start talking about some of the problems, the psyche of the formerly incarcerated, when we start talking about the psyche, we start looking at, and what we see sometimes when people get out, when they can't find jobs, when they can't find, you know, not only just jobs, but housing. That's another big issue, because a lot of individuals, when they get out of jail or prison, the stress that they go under, the stereotypes that they receive, the discrimination that they go through, it is crazy. Especially when people say that they're being rehabilitated or that I've served my time. But then it goes back to think, did they really ever serve time? Or were they just locked away, put away with nothing and, you know, given to them to help them? Now, also, when we start talking about that, empathetic increment. Do you know that the lack of empathy may be a valuable survival strategy? Not only for people in jail, but also people out of jail. I think, Cedric, that if we learn to become more empathetic and gain a better understanding, I think that that's part of helping and getting to the root of the problem. What do you think that is about that, becoming more empathetic as a nation?
I think so, because if I can't put myself in your shoes and I can't feel what you're going through, you know, I may never, you know, I'll probably never go to prison. It'll probably never happen, but I definitely can understand the pain from seeing it from the outside and seeing the, I remember one incident in particular when one of the young men that was locked up, his daughters came.
Mm-hmm.
And he had two little girls, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they were sweet, cute little girls, and I was playing with them and stuff. And then when their mom took them to see him, they didn't recognize him. Like they didn't know who he was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were like 2 and 3 years old. That just cut my heart out. I was like, oh my God, if my children didn't come run up to me immediately, you know, when they saw me with a smile on their face, I don't know what I would do. You know, but this poor young man, you know, his daughters literally did not know who he was. They were more comfortable
mm-hmm.
around me than they were him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if your heart doesn't go out to something like that, you're like, and when I'm sure, was that Ariel or Alexis? What was her name?
it's
Alexis.
Was it Alexi?
Yeah.
Alexis.
Yeah, Alexi. Yeah, Alexis.
Alexis with
when
an
you
S.
Were,
yeah.
okay. Alexis, with
yes.
You were talking about you have to bring it down to a personal level with your film. And
mm-hmm.
people can connect more when it's an individual story and it's not just stats like 1 out of every 6 young men in Sacramento is not reading at grade level. When you take an actual child that can't read at grade level in a drama and people can like, oh, that's what it feels like. That's what
mm-hmm.
you're going through.
Yes.
That's why,
yes.
you know, it's more personal. It's like my writing, like my books. You know, people
mm-hmm.
can connect with my lead characters because they feel them.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, oh, I know that dude. I know what that's like. I know what that's like to struggle with. I get it. You know, this guy has to live in 2 worlds and
mm-hmm.
I'm illustrating it. You know, it's fiction, but it's so real. That's why people have enjoyed it so much, because you can empathize with each character, even the characters you hate. You
Correct.
Can empathize
yeah.
with.
Right. But you know what? I think that that's what keeps us in tune with watching some of these shows like Power and Empire.
Sure.
And things of that nature, because we can't connect, because we can relate to it.
Right.
And there's so
right.
many individuals that want to learn about the Black culture and learn about our communities, but then, like I said, trust becomes an issue. Is it that you really want
right.
to help me, or do you want to steal from me? Are you helping me, or are well, you hurting me? Are you handicapping me? I remember when my daughter, my sister used to talk about the projects. My middle sister was far more bright than we gave her credit for. I remember when she said the project was a study, and she said they put a bunch of people in one place. They basically gave them a check, gave them food stamps, and watched them all kill themselves. And we never even looked at it like that. You know, people thought, I remember talking to a grown woman one day, and she had a credit score where she could buy her own home. She told me she'd rather move into projects. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. It's part of it
well,
is that mentality.
It's a modern-day reservation. It's what they did to the Native Americans. They're like,
mm-hmm.
we know where you're at. We'll send you a check. We'll make sure the
mm-hmm.
liquor's cheap. There's plenty of sex. Maybe you have mentally ill people. We'll let you govern yourselves. We'll put all this poison in this situation. And, of
mm-hmm.
course, it's going to be poisonous and toxic. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, you just, you're seasoning their mind, you know.
Crap.
That's all.
Can I say that I've seen this in other countries? Like,
mm-hmm.
I was in Australia, and it's the same thing with the Aboriginal.
The Aboriginal
people
sure.
there,
mm-hmm.
which is they're like the Black people of Australia, but they're basically
right.
on reservations in ghettos. They're addicted, high blood pressure rate, you know, a lot of diabetes. Like, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been to South Africa. It's the same thing.
And, you know, and that's where it becomes a bigger issue than what we try to say, or, you know, the way it's much bigger than what we think. And that's why we need help. That's why we need people to come together. We need to educate individuals. We need to be able to offer services. Now, Aaron,
right.
I know you've been silent for a minute. I want you to bring your voice back in. What do you think, as a young Black man, what do you think you needed or you would now like to give to other people? What do you think is the root? Because, like I said, we can talk about the problem all day long, but we got to come up with solutions. We got to come up with ways of restoring families, healing families. You know, once a person get out of jail, I know that there are programs out there to have, like, second chances. I always give them the people, you know, information when I find out places that are hiring, that are felony-friendly. What do you think we can do to help individuals?
Well, I think a lot of the things that were talked about that we're kind of seeing happening in our community with people aren't really problems, but like again, like I said before, they're the symptoms
mm-hmm.
of these problems. And I think and a lot of this stuff is because of systemic racism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about like the sister was talking about like the crime in Chicago. Yeah, you know, when you tear down two projects and move everybody into one project, and there's pretty much zero resources, people are going to kill each other, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So if there was more resources in community, if there was more, like you said, opportunities, and not just jobs, but jobs that allow upward mobility, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jobs that would give people a livable wage to where they could provide for themselves and their children, then you wouldn't see crime, right? Crime again
mm-hmm.
is a symptom of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Father Greg Boyle in Los Angeles has a organization called Homeboy Industries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard of Homeboy Industries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have a slogan. They have a slogan that says nothing stops a bullet better than a job, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I've never known anybody to go ride on payday. Right. So, if we would have more preventative measures in our community,
mm-hmm.
then we wouldn't always have to be reacting when things happen.
Right.
And that's what I feel like. So economics is a big part of it. You know, education is a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois kind of says it best, you know, a system cannot fail those it was never designed to protect, right?
Correct.
So,
correct.
we this isn't anything new or surprising. We're just going to have to constantly be combating these things. And I like what the brother has said earlier, is a big part of it is we're taking a system that wasn't built for us, that we were put into, and trying to integrate into it, right? And you're trying to integrate into a system that wasn't designed for you. So we're going to constantly be running into roadblocks.
Correct. And you know what? And like I said, because I know I ran into some roadblocks with just even opening up, you know, trying to do therapy, trying to offer programs, trying to offer services, trying to go into schools, trying to, you know, I remember recently I was working in San Diego and I had a principal basically didn't want me talking to her students. And I'm like, well, what am I getting paid for if you don't want me to talk to your students? And it was just sad because when we start talking about racism, racism is based on fear and ignorance because they don't know any better. And they're so afraid, they're thinking that, and they don't even have a clue, And now when we start even talking about racism, we have so many children that are biracial, that adds a whole nother factor because when these children that are, you know, being born and they're biracial, they're struggling with identity issues, too, of what side am I supposed to fit in on? You know, I have a grandson. My grandson, mama, white. My son is black. So do we start talking about the system and the white person is? And you'd be like, well, my mama white, you know. So sometimes we do have to get to the point to where we have to, like I said, become empathetic. We have to provide valuable information. We have to start teaching individuals, and we have to also teach individuals how to love and respect themselves. I think that that also plays a role in it, too, is your morals, your values, you know, because like the like Aaron was saying earlier, we don't just grow up and say, wow, I want to be a drug dealer, because I know that was one thing I never wanted to be because I couldn't stand it. I didn't want to be around. To this day, I still don't know what it's like to be drunk or high, and I don't want to know what it feels like. Because I just did not like it. I didn't want to see it. But then I have to help individuals learn how to have a lifestyle change. And part of it is changing the way you think, changing your attitudes, your beliefs, and your perceptions about things. Because if we do nothing, we're not going to get anywhere. And like I said, I want to thank you, Aaron, for the work that you're doing in San Diego in the community. I want to thank my cousin, Alexis, for what she's doing and in the film and the project. And like I said, anything I could do to help you, let me know, because I wanted you to share that because I told you I have a lot of followers on my Facebook and things of that nature and also in my LinkedIn account that hopefully I'll post it on there too. So, you know, we can try to get this film up and going to try to help bring things to the community as a sense of awareness. And Cedric, like I said, you know I am proud of you and I always have fun whenever you join me on the radio.
Yeah.
Because you also bring a lot to the table with in regards to, you know, your writing. And I could also say for my family, even though what we've been through, we come from a very, very talented family. We have individuals in our family that are doing a lot and doing it and have been doing so for many, 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 many years.
Yeah.
And we're just the I want to call it the runt, you know, because even though we're getting older now. But, you know, there were people before us that were trying to pave the way, and they were probably afraid for us to do some of the things that we do. Because when I hear my little cousin speak, I'd be like, oh, you just don't have a clue, baby. You just don't know. But it's just interesting because we still had it in us, even though we were kind of shunned from a lot of things because they didn't want us to get involved, because they didn't want us to get hurt. And a lot of it becomes protection. I want to protect you. I don't want you to be getting in the middle of all of this. Baby, leave it alone. No, some things you just can't leave alone. Some things you have to do something. So I used to always say, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And we need to stop falling. We need to stop blaming. We need to, you know, do our part. Just basically do our part. Now, anything
we
got to
pick each other
say,
up, too, girl.
Yes, we do. Encourage one another, lift one another up, and stop killing one another. And one of the things we do is we beat each other down with words and negativity. We really need to stop that because a lot of that hate, that self-hate, which goes into my show for next week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about I love you, but I love me more. Because a lot of times people don't even know what love means. You know, it kind of takes me back. I never forget when Holly Berry said, "Love should have brought you home last night." But we throw that word around, not really realizing what it actually means. So I want to thank you guys. I want to thank you, cousins, for joining me on the show and the support that you're giving me. I want to thank you, Aaron. I'm going to try to make arrangements to make it to your event as I work in Orange County on Saturdays, but I'm going to do my best to be there. So, again, join me next week at Precious Predicaments, Blog Talk Radio. And if you have any information you want me to share, you can email me, you can inbox me on Facebook. Until next week, remember,
thank you.
You got this. Thank you guys.
Jeanette.
You're welcome. Thank
all
you.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank
peace
you.
And blessings.
Appreciate you too. Bye bye.
Oh?
Yes,
fine.
What do you mean?
In the car, they come in for your car and then they come up here. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. What'd you say? I have a spot.